Come all ye young fellas, so young and so fine, and seek not your fortune in the dark, dreary mine. It will form as a habit and seep in your soul, till the stream of your blood runs as black as the coal. Where it's dark as a dungeon and damp as the dew, where the dangers are double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our guest today is Zach Werkowich with History Colorado. He's a member of Colorado Winds, the State Employees Union, Local 1876, and is the lead developer on a new exhibit at the El Pueblo Museum called Steel City, 1980 to 2004. Welcome to the Labor Exchange.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. First, we like to start off our shows by getting to know our guests a little more. Tell me a little bit about your personal story and what brought you to the museum.
Yeah. So my name is Zach. I live here in Pueblo. I've been here about 13 and a half years. I actually moved to Pueblo with the labor movement. I was an organizer for Colorado Winds for many years before I started at the museum. Building worker power for people at the Colorado Mental Health Institute, in colleges around the state, Department of Corrections. And that experience like really shaped who I am. I grew up hearing stories from my grandpa was an auto worker. He built Ford trucks for 35 years. And that was important. Those were important stories that we heard in our family growing up. And that pointed me in the direction of like working in the labor movement. A number of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago now, I was laid off from Colorado Winds. And this job at the museum, doing community relations is a lot, it happened to be the right thing at the right time. So, I worked to get the word out about History Colorado's programs and events and stories that we're telling to people in communities around the state. And I bring an organizer's perspective to that.
Our guest is Zach Werkowich with History Colorado. We're talking about the exhibit down in Pueblo called the Steel City 1980 to 2004. With those dates, the 1980 to 2004, what are some of the key events covered, the history covered by the exhibit?
The reason we looked at that era, it's a 25-year, like just a pretty neat segment of time. In the late 70s, in like 1979, there were somewhere around 8,000 people working at the mill. And at that time, they were still, making steel from coal and iron, smelting it here, rolling out tubes and bars and rails, as well as the newer processed in electric arc furnace, where basically like melting down scrap steel to make their products. So 1980, 8,000 people or so working there. But what was happening in the rest of the world is that, Western Europe and Japan, their steel industries were destroyed during World War II, and they were built back, with like much more modern methods. And CF&I was not as bad as some of the other players in back east, but basically like the foreign steel was dumped into the domestic market and caused massive disruption to the steel industry. between 1980 and 1984, the plant went from, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 people to about 900 or 1,000 people working there, which in a town of 100,000 people is devastating, obviously. You know, 8 or 10% of the people, of the residents of the town working at the mill. And so by the mid-80s, the plant here was employing a fraction of what it had been employing five years or 10 years earlier. But it limped along. There was trouble with the pension. It was spun off from the Crane Corporation, which had owned it previously. It was sort of made to go independent. But it was limping along. By the early 90s, in the fall of 1991, CF&I declared bankruptcy, which was a terrifying prospect here, even though the mill employed a fraction of what of the people that had been working there. Those were still like union jobs, you know, good wages and benefits and pensions. And aside from the wages alone, the pensioners have a really significant portion of the population in Southern Colorado. So the company declared bankruptcy, but luckily, through community efforts and concessions from the workforce, eventually, like it was bought by Oregon Steel, headquartered in Portland. They had other steel mills along the West Coast. And the workforce, the two unions there signed a five-year contract with Oregon Steel to keep the mill running. What was certainly known at the time, but not talked about in the newspaper for sure, was Oregon Steel's record of breaking its unions. They broke unions in Portland and Napa in the 1980s. And they came when that five-year contract was up, that was their plan here, was to break the union here in Pueblo. But the steelworkers here in the community, like, were not going to let that happen. They voted to go on strike in October of 97. And then, with some flurry of like back and forth and some intricacies of in some esoteric labor law, like it ended up it moved from a strike to but basically they were on strike for 7 years after that.
And I get you're struggling a little bit explaining some of the intricacies, because I've dug pretty deep into this, and it's for our listeners, it's fairly complicated, because there's arguments between the company and the union over whether this is an economic or non-economic strike. There's also even more complexity than that, but the basic underlying thing is that reactions through the courts or other means, moved what was happening because of the way the legal system works around labor. It's incredibly complicated. I think it'll be a little too hard for me to even, come off and summarize this on a sidebar.
The sort of gist is that, by December, the union, the two unions offered to come back to work, and the company said, no, we've replaced you with scabs. And that's where the whole decision hinged, and that's what you mean is like, is it an economic strike or a working conditions or unfair labor practice strike? But the workforce here carried on for 7 years, and that meant picket lines at the gates. It meant rallying support from neighbors and businesses around the community. And also, really significantly, steelworkers led really a new phase in sort of not just grassroots unionism, but grassroots organizing nationwide. Steelworkers from Pueblo, Joel Buchanan is one, they ended up going all over the country and eventually targeting not just Oregon Steel, but Wells Fargo, which is like the company credit card, to put economic pressure on the company. And through, you know, numerous conversations and presentations at meetings and all sorts of grassroots tactics, got other union allies, universities, municipalities to withdraw tens of billions, I think $14 billion or something from Wells Fargo as economic sanctions against against Oregon Steel. And eventually, you know, there's a lot more to say about all of that, but 2004, the company came back to the table. There was a court order, again, like kind of esoteric court maneuverings and legal maneuverings. But the steelworkers here won the biggest back pay in labor history to that time.
And kept their union. I think that's really, that really was, this was an attempt to destroy that union. You mentioned Joel Buchanan. Can you speak a little bit to the people that are highlighted in the exhibit and just some of the background there?
Yeah, really key to so much of the work that History Colorado does is collecting in communities. And so one of the ways that we researched, you know, this is really recent research. There's not been many books written. I think maybe no books written about this strike in particular. So we had to look other places for getting the sources for this. So we conducted a number of oral history interviews with steelworkers and community members. Joel Buchanan was one of those. He had started at the mill in 1970. And he was involved with the union. And the story he told us was that shortly before they went on strike, he was injured on the job and still like made his, you know, fulfilled his duties on the picket line. But he was one who was recruited to go around the country. And I think he went to Houston and Portland and Seattle and San Francisco and spent years on the road with the Road Warriors, with the United Steelworkers.
Yeah, Road Warriors was the name for the group that was running around for this, trying to get people to explain to people why they needed to take their money out of Wells Fargo to support the steelworkers in Pueblo.
Exactly, that's right. Yeah, some of the other folks we talked to, Georgina Daffin was a steelworker who endured the strike and went back to work afterwards. Arthur Yarbrough is currently, this is a kind of an interesting story. One of the things that steelworkers, one of the like legal maneuverings that they were able to accomplish during their strike was to be eligible for unemployment benefits. And then also through that to be eligible for retraining benefits. And so Arthur Yarbrough was a steelworker, 20 years experience or something at the mill. And when they went on strike, eventually the union sent him to, I don't know if it was the union or if it was the state sort of workforce benefits, but he ended up earning a master's in social work. He's currently a social worker and a member of Colorado Winds, my local. And then some of the other folks we talked to as well, we talked to a city manager, Jim Munch, who was maybe not a city manager at the time, a city planner in the 1980s and 1990s, told us about how, about the impacts of those massive layoffs, like what were the ripple effects through the community. We talked with Bernie Zerker, who is the contractor who kind of got this ball rolling with talking about keeping the plant, the company afloat in the early 90s. And then luckily the community here is so generous with not just sharing stories, but also sharing photographs. We got dozens or hundreds maybe of photos from the period that are many of them on display. And then another key element of our research, because again, there's not a ton of academic sources at this point, for such recent history, but the Pueblo Library really generously shared, you know, archives of the Pueblo chieftain, which, you know, the chieftain had a line, like they were not an impartial observer, I would say. But it was an interesting, it was an interesting view at like the story that was being told to the community by the paper.
And I know I had at one point read through some of the archives at the local, and it was interesting because, of course, they for legal reasons were archiving every article in the Oregon paper and the Denver paper and the Pueblo paper. And I think you're right. We could just say it's Pueblo chieftain. You know, it might be revealed by the name that they keep, but they have a conservative bent. Definitely during this time, especially, they were not on the side of the workers. Hey, can you talk about some of the tactics that were used? I know I had heard some stories about them going to Oregon and people chaining themselves, anything like that. Can you talk a little about the tactics?
Yeah, one of the oral histories we conducted was with Lynn Bezek, who is the wife of a steel worker. She went to Oregon. She went to Portland in 98, 99. A number of women, they called themselves Women of Steel, went to Oregon and chained themselves to the company headquarters until they were arrested. Joel, and Lynn both tell about those in their oral histories, which I should mention, they're available on our SoundCloud. You can listen to all of the oral histories we collected at, I think it's soundcloud.com/historycolorado. There's a Steel City playlist there with a number of oral histories. So that was one of the tactics. Joel talked about how they arranged at that time for the fire department, you know, union firefighters at the time in Portland. They prearranged, you let us know how long you need to be in there, and then we'll let the cops in to haul you out after you've made your statement. We also, you know, learned at a SOAR meeting, I think, the Steelworkers Retirees chapter. Joel's girlfriend at the time was the person carrying the money for bail. But she was proud of that. And it was an interesting thing to hear. They ended up getting support from so many people and organizations around the country. I'm trying to think of some of the other stories.
Yeah, well, and I think the civil disobedience is a part of this, because these corporate campaigns, really, it's about understanding the company, where it's going, where you have leverage points to make a difference. And that's getting like this, where they get people tied to Wells Fargo to, you know, take notice on that. We're talking with Zach Werkowich with the History Colorado. We're talking about the Steel City 1980 to 2004 exhibit at the El Pueblo Museum. If you haven't gone, the El Pueblo Museum is great. It's affordable. And if you have a History Colorado pass, you can visit all of the regional museums, not just that main one downtown in Denver. So the Colorado AFL-CIO's earliest incarnation was founded in Pueblo on May Day, 1896. The Southern Colorado Labor Council still holds that as their founding date. What do you think unions mean to Pueblo?
First of all, that's news to me. Really cool information to hear. I wonder where it was. If you'll indulge me for a second to go on a bit of a tangent, I wonder where it was incorporated. Where I sit right now is two blocks away from the Mineral Palace Park, which was once home to the Colorado Mineral Palace. And a little bit of side promotion, I guess, we're opening an exhibit on the Colorado Mineral Palace, which is this giant sort of legendary building that once stood in this neighborhood and was torn down and has sort of descended into myth and urban legend.
Yeah, well, and there's massive men made of, and King Cole was King stolen. Cole, and
yeah, Silver Queen, yeah, madness. But I know the AFL like in the early 20th century, had a number of conventions and meetings there. So I wonder if that's where Colorado AFL-CIO was incorporated.
Yeah. You know, what other stories need to be told? Let's think, you know, through, you know, with you're in Southern Colorado and Pueblo, you know, you talked about Mineral Palace Park. I would love to know more about that. I would love to like travel back in time and see it. It was such a strange, yeah, myth is the thing. It reminds me of like the Coliseum, right? Like that's how I feel if like the after, you know, King Cole's been stolen or whatever, there's all that history. Yeah. It's sort of like, you know, half derelict, but like also still used for things. Like I'm just uh-huh. like, the context isn't there. It's hard.
It's fascinating. And that exhibit opens this Friday, the 9th. So yeah, come and see it.
Yeah, I'll be down.
I would say some of the stories that labor history specifically that need to be, that haven't been told as much in Southern Colorado. I think the 1927 strike in the coal fields, the Wobblies, is undertold, but fascinating. Really, the history of all of this is still being written, but especially I think the teacher strikes of 2018. I think those are potentially some really interesting stories as the picture of education and teacher activism unfolds will be interesting to follow.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking you know, a longer view and starting to tell some of these stories, because I think to some folks like me, like I'm, you know, gonna turn 40, you know, the Dang. 1980s and 90s. I know, man, it's we've known each other a long time, folks, too, just for our listeners. So but you know, just seeing, it doesn't seem so far to me, but like that's that time frame where if we're not, you know, gathering that history, it will be lost. There will be stories we will not know if we don't do right. that. Yeah. yeah. And I'm actually remembering back, I came down for one of your oral history collections, and one of your staffers, I believe, is it Jose?
Yeah.
What's his last name?
Ortega.
So Jose Ortega, wonderful staffer, runs this, you know, really interesting way of like pulling stories out of the community and just sitting there. But I have this memory of a woman who came with her husband. He worked in the mill, and she kept saying like, I didn't do anything. I wasn't a part of this. I was, you know, they were working in the mill. I was just here. And then later revealed like that she had done food distribution network and like was a huge part of the community support that kept people going.
Totally. Yeah. When it's that sort of thing that, you know, steel workers will tell you, I think that it's that sort of thing that kept them on the picket line. Like there was plenty of incentive to keep showing up, but like part of the thing that kept them, that got them out there, you know, 6 a.m. in a historic blizzard in October of 97 was that, like, you know, Auntie Bev from across the street from the mill was out there handing out burritos and hamburgers to everybody on the picket line. She owns a restaurant in Bessemer still, just moved just before the pandemic, a little ways away from the mill, but it had for 20 years been the front of her restaurant faces the mill, right by the Indiana Gate, I guess. She opened it in the summer of 1997. And so she's so sweet and her food is so good. You should go. We asked her, you know, so many steelworkers mentioned, like, Auntie Bev was out there every day handing out burritos and hamburgers. And so we sat down with her to ask her about, you know, her memories of the strike and why did she do it and what kept her going. And really, what she told us was that, you know, we asked how many hamburgers did you give out? And she said, I don't have any idea. I didn't even keep track. Just knew that the Lord would provide, and this brand new restaurant kept going. But, and the community, I think, has paid her back. Like, she's still making really good burritos, really excellent stuffed sopapilla.
Well, Well, and I think having lived in Pueblo myself too, that does just feel very familiar to me, the selflessness that you see amongst people to help each other. And I do think that was a big part of the this whole story, 1980 to 2004, was like, it's, you know, yes, it's the union, but it was really, how did the community survive? And how did it get to a place where we still have great union jobs? We're still building U.S. made American steel that we can use in our projects here locally. And that was, to me, you know, a testament to the community coming together, along with just some really bright people working really hard, tirelessly to do something to make sure this didn't just get swept under the rug, like so many things do.
That's right. Yeah. It's having been an organizer, you know, I would say, consider myself an organizer still by vocation. It's a wonder to me how they kept the energy going for 7 years. And I guess at a certain point, like it gains a momentum of its own. And but obviously, like, the organizing work that was done up to the strike, up to walking out and then through, and the amount of like solidarity among the workforce, I guess there's just not words for it probably, but and then really like the solidarity and support from their neighbors and friends and business owners. Like, it took everybody, I guess.
Yeah, it really did. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today and sharing about this important exhibit down at the El Pueblo Museum.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on to talk about these stories. And yeah, thank you.
This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. Our guest today is Zach Workowicz, Community Relations Director for History Colorado. We've been discussing a new exhibit at the El Pueblo Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, called Steel City, 1980 to 2004. The Labor Exchange is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Find more great radio at laborradionetwork.org. The Labor Exchange would like to wish you a very happy Labor Day, and we want to recognize that even though this is a holiday for workers, many of you have worked hard today, and we thank you for it. We'll end with a short audio clip from a worker at Brewing Market in Lafayette speaking at a rally this last Sunday supporting their effort to unionize. We'd also like to thank the Boulder Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Our music this episode has been Dark as a Dungeon by Merle Travis, performed this past Sunday there by Pete Wernick.
The relationships that we formed and the solidarity we're showing each other and the imagination that we have for a better world were unstoppable. So thank you so much.
Come all ye young fellas, so young and so fine. Seek not your fortune in the dark, dreary mine. It will form as a habit and seep in your soul till the stream of your blood runs as black as the coal. Where it's dark as a dungeon, damp as the dew, where the dangers are double and the pleasures are few, where the rain never falls and the sun never shines. It's dark as a dungeon way down in